Okay, at this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting at Central Orlando... At the Central Orlando Group Saturday Night Speakers Meeting are 1 year of continuous sobriety. Have centralized your home group and attend a group conscious meeting. I've met all those requirements. My name is Marty. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date's February 15th of 2008, and I came in here homeless and hopeless, and it's only through the grace of God and His mercy that I'm allowed to stand up here this evening. A has been very good to me. It not only has kept me sober, it's shown me a new way to live my life and gotten me in touch with my ultimate sponsor, which is God. And I've had a really good year. And sometimes I look back and I think, why do I deserve something like this, considering some of the things I did during my drinking? And I realized that something that my sponsor told me a long time ago, when I was first going through the steps, says if I'm asking God to forgive me and I'm asking other people to forgive me when I'm doing my ninth step, what right do I have not to forgive anyone else or myself? Am I playing God? You know, if God can forgive me, why can't I forgive other people and everyone else? So, I don't know, it's just, I'm looking forward to growing. I really am. And I want to remind everyone, the group's asked me to remind you to please make sure your cell phones are off and to refrain from moving around or talking while the person is sharing. And our speaker tonight is probably, matter of fact, I know he's more nervous than I am. It's his first time here speaking at Central, and by God, he's up here every Saturday night, and I don't know why he's nervous at all. He does the raffle. But I've had the honor of working with Gina as his sponsor for the past year and a half, 2 years, and I've heard his story several times, and I know other people here have heard bits and pieces of it, and I'm really looking forward to hearing it again, the whole shebang all wrapped up in one. So you came here to hear him and not me. Here's Gene.
Marty ain't lying. I'm scared shitless. You know, I was one of those people. I loved attention.
Who are you?
Oh, my name's Gene. I'm an alcoholic. I love attention, but when this here is a lot different. But it's also an honor and a privilege to be here and looking out at these wonderful, beautiful ladies and gentlemen out here that are in here tonight with me for the same reasons that I'm here, is to better my life, do something different, change. I was thinking for the last month and a half since I was told I was going to speak what I was going to say or how to say it up here. You know, I could sit here and give you this really glum story of how much of a victim I was all my life or most of my life, and that was my major excuse for drinking. However, that's not what it's about. You know, I'm not looking for pity. I'm not looking for people to feel sorry. What I am here to do is share my experience, strength, and hope with you today. So I'd like to start out by, I was born and raised in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, a little town called Roxbury, Manioc area.
Oh yeah.
And you know, you got three churches in a bar on a corner, or three bars in a church on a corner out there, because it's an Irish, German, Polish, Catholic neighborhood, and that's basically what it was. But back when I was a kid growing up, you know, your parents were allowed to send you down to the corner tap room to get them beer. You know, 5, 6 years old, you go down and you get your papa a quart or something. And, you know, and my dad, unfortunately, I come from a very abusive alcoholic home. So the only thing I ever know was drinking. Used to steal my father's beer when I was a kid, or they'd give it to me, or give me a little shot of whiskey, you know. Parents fed me vodka and orange juice in my bottle at a very young age to help us kids go to sleep so they can go out to the bar and things like that. I'm the second oldest of six. I have two other brothers and three other brothers and two sisters. And I dealt with a lot of abuse. My mother was abused. I was abused. However, my father never touched my brothers and sisters. But I discovered at a very young age, I was about 5.5 to 6 years old, you know, I liked the taste of the beer. I loved it when I was a kid. And my father sent me down to the tap room to get him some beer, and I figured, well, this time I'm just going to get two, and I'm going to drink one. And I drank one home, and I don't remember what happened. You know, I don't even know if I finished the whole thing. I know I was hammered. And I woke up the next day, and I was pretty beat up. And My mom told me, what were you thinking? I said, well, what happened? She says, you came home drunker than shit. And, you know, your father just whooped the shit out of you. And I thought, he did? Wow, that's the first time my father ever beat the shit out of me and I didn't feel it. I thought, that'll work. That will work, you know? And I began to drink, smoke cigarettes at about 5.5 to 6 years old. And that was my life. My life was lying, cheating, stealing, manipulating, conning, getting into trouble. My first arrest was 5 years old. I was arrested at 5 years old for stealing $43.59 worth of toys from a store called Kitty City. It's like a Toys R Us. Sitting out in the parking lot playing it with another kid. The police literally came, handcuffed us, took us to the jail, and put us in a cell. And my old man told them to leave me there. And I was left there. And then eventually my father paid the toy store off and brought me home and beat the living piss out of me. But, you know, that's what I get. But as time went on, me and my brothers and sisters were eventually taken away from my parents. And I grew up in orphanage homes, institutions, juvenile detention centers. And I hung around the best kids, you know, because, you know, that's what I learned. I was raised in the streets pretty much most of my life. Running away, 11, 12 years old, I ran away to Florida, moved to Stuart, Florida for a couple of years with the entire country looking for me and didn't know whether I was kidnapped or where I was. And eventually I called them up, said I want to come home, and they bought me a plane ticket and sent me home. So, and I guess right before that, at about 10 years old, my father, before we were taken away, my father had shipped me off to a treatment center. Because I was seeing a child psychologist, and they decided that I had a drinking problem. I was busted in second grade with a bottle of booze, cigarettes, and I was thrown out of Catholic school for that. I flunked first grade because I was left-handed, and they didn't know how to teach a left-handed person how to write. I was also dyslexic. So that's kind of my younger childhood, you know. And when I went to my first AA meeting at the age of 10, I got out and they said you had to go to these AA meetings. And at the time, I didn't really know what the hell AA was. And, you know, I know we watched movies like Go Ask Alice and things like that, if anybody's ever seen that. But it's about an alcoholic young girl who became an alcoholic. And, it, you know, it's a horrible story. But I identified to that girl because I drank like her at a young age. And so I went to my first AA meeting, and I'm standing there, and a guy comes up and he's like, how you doing, son? I said, how you doing, sir? He says, you here with your folks? I said, no, sir. He says, well, where are your folks at? I said, probably down the street at the bar getting drunk. He says, well, what are you doing here? I said, I just came from this hospital. They told me I had to go to AA meetings. He said, how old are you? I said, I'm 10. And he said, well, why don't you come back in a few years when you got a little bit more experience? I said, thank you. That's what I told him. You know? And off to the races I went. I was being shipped from juvenile homes to orphanage homes to institutions. Everybody's trying to fix Gene. Nobody could fix me. I was already a rebel. I hated the world. I isolated. I didn't have any friends. My friends were the winos on the street, the guys who's the older teenagers, 18, 19 years old, who stood on the corners and drinking. And I was a bootblack. I shined shoes in the bars from about 6 years old on to 16. And I made more money at 6 years old a week than my father made. And my father used to say, give me your money, I'm going to put it in the bank. Well, later on in years, I found out my father didn't put it in the bank. But also, 1 o'clock in the morning, when my father didn't have any money and didn't have any booze, he'd wake me up in the middle of the night, kick my ass all the way down the stairs and tell me to go out and make him some money and don't come home until I have some. And I thank God a couple of the bar owners knew me, and they'd come in, and I'd go in at 1 o'clock in the morning, and they'd say, your old man needs something. I said, yeah. And they'd throw me $5 and give me a quart and send me home. I give it to my old man, I go to bed. And that was pretty much it. And eventually went to the orphanage home. I would always stay in the orphanage home under the condition I could still shine shoes. That was my life. I loved it. I loved it because I was in my own little space. I had my own little world going on. Well, eventually my father got wind of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got sober, and I was in an institution, and I didn't see my father. My only weekends were to get away with my father. By this time, my mother was in a abusive woman's shelter, you know, getting the help she needed from being abused. She was put in a coma 3 times by my father. It was alcohol abuse in my home. That's all I knew. We went to family functions. My grandmother used to say, well, if your mother wouldn't do the things she did, your father wouldn't beat her ass. And I was like, you know, you're a pretty sick woman. And I told her that one day, and my dad's baby brother punched me in my face. I said, don't you ever talk to my mom like that. You know, and I didn't have a very good relationship with my family. I lied, I cheated, I stole from them. I stole anything I could, but most of the time when I stole something from them, it was to feed my brothers and sisters because there was no food in the refrigerator to feed them with. And I hid money from shoe shining. I dug a hole in the yard, and I would hide the money to feed my brothers and sisters. You know, I live in rat-infested homes, you know. And I tell you this because that's how bad it was. You know, I want to come here and tell you this wonderful story that I was a high-bottom drunk, but I was a low-bottom drunk because that's what I was taught. I was taught to survive. I had no living skills. Not that I didn't have the opportunity, mind you. Somebody always reminds me that a lot of my troubles are of my own making. And even at that young of age, you know, I had an opportunity to go a different way, and I chose to go the way I went. Well, my father, I was about 14 years old, decided to get sober, and all my brothers and sisters are in foster homes and are doing really, really well. And I'm in an orphanage home, and my father turns around and he says, well, you're going to come live with me. And I'm bringing all the brothers and sisters home. This is after about 3 years sober. And I had gotten kicked out of the home, and I had to stay with him in this one-room shack out in Norristown, Pennsylvania. And he got himself a girlfriend, and after about 3 or 4 years sober, he decided he's going to just... And I said, well, why are you going to take my brothers and sisters out of their wonderful homes where they're doing so well and move us in together? And I don't want to live with you because I'm going to make your life a living hell like you made mine. So at 14 years old, I made a conscious decision that I was going to screw his life up without realizing how bad it was going to screw my life up. And I proceeded to do that. I got in trouble in school. I got arrested. I made him bond me out. I was drinking with his old drinking buddies, his baby brother's old drinking buddies. I was partying, I got into other substances, and, you know, that's what my life became. You know, I take off, I put my thumb out on a highway. I loved hitchhiking cross country. I loved it, and I love it today, because I can get out anywhere and I can find a party anywhere. You know, no matter where I went, there, you know, there I was. You know, just the faces changed. You know, the places were the same, the people were the same. You know, they were drunk just like me, or living homeless in the streets. My favorite place in the world to live was in Nashville, Tennessee, along the railroad tracks. There was a guy down there, they had all these homeless cardboard boxes, but they'd fix them up like little homes, and you had a guy down there was an electrician, and he hooked up electricity to the train tracks. So, you know, here we were homeless, but we had electricity and TVs and everything else living along the railroad tracks. And then the damn tornadoes came and tore them down. You know, so that was pretty much it, you know. I went through a few treatment centers, but my father got sober, and we all moved in with him, and I proceeded to make his life a living hell. At 18 years old, my father decided he's kicking me out of the house. I had about 2 months to go before I graduated high school. And the only reason I stayed in high school because of a teacher. Her name was Valerie Pananto, and I'll never forget this woman. God bless her soul. That woman stuck by me. She tried to help me in every way I could. And my senior year, second semester, 2 weeks before the second semester was up, I asked her birthday was coming up, and I said, what do you want for your birthday? She said, I want you to make honor roll next semester. And I looked at her and I said, don't ask me to do that. I said, I'll tell you what if I do it this semester? She said, you got 2 weeks left. Well, not only did I make honor roll that semester, I got straight A's and I got the highest GPA in the school that year, that semester. You know, I wasn't dumb. I just played dumb because nobody else cared, so why should I? If I got straight A's when I was a kid, I got my ass beat because I cheated and I didn't deserve it. And if I failed, I got my ass beat, so it didn't matter to me. I just gave up on life. I gave up on living. You know, and got kicked out of orphanage homes, got kicked out of mental institutions, got kicked out of juvenile detention centers. Nobody wanted me, you know. And I don't know if it was just bad or maybe I wasn't that bad of a person, you know, and I just needed that right push. So my father kicked me out. I transferred schools. I went to a different school after a while because they found out that I was living out of that area and I was riding a bicycle 30 miles one way to so I can graduate. Well, eventually they found out, and then I transferred to school. 2 weeks before that graduation, I walked into school, and I had a joint in my hand, and the principal, I walked, butted right into the principal, and he says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going to class." He said, "What's that in your hand?" And I looked down, and I said, "Shit." And he sat up against the wall, and I walked out of the school, and I never graduated. As time went on, I became homeless, living in the city of Philadelphia, down in the streets, downtown, panhandling, stealing, you know, whatever I had to do to get money, you know. And you know, my father never spoke to me. He never spoke to me after that. I had joined the Army, and I went into the delayed entry program, and I was leaving on January 4th of 1985. And I decided to go on a party and say goodbye to everybody that I knew, you know, and in all the bars. And, you know, it was a good way to get drinks for free. You know, people know you're leaving, and it was the holidays, and it's like, oh man, let's party it up. And that's what I did. And on December 23rd, 1984, at 3 a.m., I got back to a place. A friend of mine was letting me stay there, and the phone rang, and I picked it up, and I was cooking myself something to eat, and I was been out for about 6.5 days, just drinking and partying and whatever. And I pick up the phone, and they said, "Is Gene there?" And I said, "Yeah, this is him. This is your grandmother. I thought you'd like to know your father's dead." My father had moved to Pasadena, Texas. He took another woman's life, and he took his own in front of her 12-year-old daughter. You know, and I'm very ashamed of that. I'm ashamed of who my father was. I later find out, as I came into the rooms of AA, I found out my father might have been, he wasn't sober, he was dry. I saw a 24-hour day book around the house, but I never saw a big book. And I didn't know what a big book was until I actually came around one time for myself. And I noticed he didn't do that. In fact, my father was so miserable when he was sober, I turned around and reached in my pocket one day and pulled out $10 or $20, and I said, "Why don't you go get drunk, because you were better that way." You know, and we just didn't get along, you know. My father's a very sick man, and come to find out, I was just as sick as he was. That's what drinking did to me. And I buried my father right around December 29th, and somewhere around there, and it's December 30th, I got a Christmas card from my father the day after I buried him. And there was a space cut out. And I like to tell myself on a daily basis that that Christmas card in the space that was cut out said that I'm sorry and I love you, son. That's what I tell myself. Because I have no clue what it said. You know? And but I like to believe that. You know? My father was a very sick man. He wasn't a bad man. He was just a very sick man. And this is what I know today. I miss my father at times, as sick as that may sound, I do. Because he was my father, I loved him, for no other reason. Separated from my brothers and sisters. I went into the Army January 4th, and it became one big party at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. I mean, I stayed drunk. I stayed drunk 24/7, you know, but I managed to get through it. I moved up to about 208 pounds. All I did was drink and work out and eat. That was what my life consisted of. And I came home on leave, went to visit my family and my sisters and my brothers and all them. Basically told me they never wanted to see me again. They never wanted to hear from me. They wanted nothing to do with me. And I haven't spoken to them, you know, until recently. And I'll get to that. So, in between time, I went over to Germany, and I was stationed in Batmanhausen, Germany, 2nd 83rd Battalion Artillery, and I loved it over there. Again, it was a party, because every German holiday, or if they had an event over there, we got the day off if we participated in their folk marches or whatnot. And folk marches consisted of 5, 6, 7K walks, and there was a beer tent about every half a K. So, you know, you were lucky to make it 2K before you were hammered, you know, or staggering, or there were three just holding each other up, walking this 5K. And that's basically what it was. I had a blackout, one of many, somewhere around June 15th of 1985, over in Babenhausen, Germany. And I woke up, I was in the Frankfurt, Germany hospital with two MPs standing next to me. And a JAG attorney came up and saw me, and they all gave me my rights. Told me I was looking at 25 to life in Fort Leavenworth, Texas. I had no clue what I did. I could tell you what they told me I did. I don't believe that I did this, and it was as bad as they made it sound, but maybe it was. But they told me I stormed into a battalion commander's office, who happened to be a two-star general, and I told him he had 24 hours to get me home, or I was going to blow this base up and shoot every soldier on the base. And I don't see myself saying that. I wasn't a violent person. You know, but that's basically what I was told. And instead, what they did, the JAG officer came and saw me, and they gave me a Section 17. They gave me a general under honorable conditions discharge. Under the conditions, I would never attempt to join this man's army again. And I said, okay. And it was best that I took that, and that's what I did. I got home, I went on a rampage, drinking heavily. Got connected with one of my brothers there for a little while, my oldest brother. Some people here know my oldest brother. You know, this is how I went up. He's the reason I wound up in Orlando, and I'll explain that. But and I went on this drinking rampage, and I got involved with some drugs there, pretty bad. And you know, up north, you know, if none of y'all been up there, they have radiators that are like, they stand in the house and they're above ground. Well, I was over at a buddy's house, and I was being able to stay there, and I decided one Friday night I did not want to go out. I wanted to kick this, you know, so I handcuffed myself to that radiator. Well, lo and behold, they took off for the weekend. Okay? So I had to sit against that radiator. You know, of course, I pissed myself, you know, everything else. And they came home, and the next thing you know, the ambulance came and got me and took me to the hospital. I was dehydrated and everything else. I almost died. And I decided I needed to get some help. And I went, I looked up rehabs in Philadelphia, and I found one. It was called Chiffray Medical Center. It was the old Girard Hospital in Philadelphia. And I went to this place, and I walked in, and I said, I need help. And I said, I'm an alcoholic. Among other things, and I need some help bad. And they said, well, we don't have any beds available. You're going to have to come back tomorrow. You're going to have to keep coming back every day until we get a bed available and fill out the application and see if you qualify. So I said, well, how about, I ain't got no place to go. I'm going to go sit on your front step. When you get a bed available, just come out and wake me up and bring me in. And I'm sitting out on the step, and about 2-3 hours went by, and this lady comes walking in, and she comes out about a half hour later. She says, are you Gene? And I said, yes. And she says, what's your last name? And I said, Vetter. She says, is your father Carl? And I said, yes. She says, come with me. You're getting in here right now. I don't know who this lady was to this day, but I do know she knew my father. And she got me into this 28-day program. Now, again, you know, I didn't have a drinking problem when I went in there. I had a drug problem. Very important, because I wanted to continue to drink, you know. And I stayed clean for a little while, and I got a job, and I had a, you know, and I did well. But I decided, okay, I can drink now. You know, I just have to stay away from the other products. And lo and behold, I found out I had a drinking problem, so I decided to go to AA. And stopped going to NA, and realized maybe I didn't have a drug problem. I had a drinking problem. So I started using drugs without drinking, and of course that didn't last. And I went to another treatment center, and then another treatment center, and then another treatment center. My brother, my oldest brother Dan, was down here in Orlando, and he won't mind me saying his name, because he himself used to sit in his room and say he was an alcoholic. right here at Central. And I was down in Philadelphia watching the Eagles game at a bar one night. It was about probably 20 below zero, snowing out, and I had a denim jacket and a t-shirt on, a pair of sneakers and jeans. And I left, and I was pissed off because the Eagles lost, so I decided to walk down the highway, and I said, I'm getting the hell out of this town. I left everything I owned. There was nothing really left for me to stay there for. My family disowned me. I had no friends, you know. Nobody wanted to be around me at that point. And I put my thumb out on I-95, and I stayed on the highway for a couple of months, you know, going with the van lines, moving people, until I wound up in Orlando, Florida, and looked up my brother and found him. And lo and behold, he had relapsed, and he was out drinking again. So we went out on a nice party run for a little while, and he got back into the rooms, and I took off to somewhere. It might have been California or something. I took off at a carnival or something. And so then I wind up coming back to Orlando, and my brother was sober again, and he brought me into the rooms. He's living out in Castleberry, going to the happy hour group in a Rebo's club, and I got involved out there a little bit, and I stayed sober. And never worked the steps. I got a sponsor to say I had a sponsor, but it was all about activities with him, you know. I started a recovery bowling league down there at the Rebo's Club about 20 years ago. It wasn't just a team, it was an entire league. We took up 32 lanes and lasted for, I think, 3 years before it finally dissolved. I was only involved with it for one of those seasons. And I decided to go drinking again, and because I wasn't in the rooms for the right reason. I was in there to rest, or I was in there to get a job, and that's what I came to AA for most of my life. I come in here to save a relationship, to find a relationship, because I figured that would fix me. I come in here to get a job because I figured that would fix me, and working with somebody in recovery would help. You know, it's all bullshit. It was to put money in my pocket so I wouldn't be alone. You know, and I always wound up getting drunk again. Every time. 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, go back out getting drunk. In and out of Alcoholics Anonymous probably since I was about 17 years old. And never got sober. And, you know, the time before I got sober this time, I went to a place, I came to Central. And I slept outside of Central, and they had people from Central calling the Harbor House, which is the William R. Just Center down on Michigan in Nashville. And Al kept getting his phone call, and one day he said, send this son of a bitch down here. And I got down there after about 4 days of people calling up and saying, look, man, this guy's really trying. He's staying sober. He's sleeping outside. He's going to meetings all day. He's sticking around Central. And I went down there and he did an interview, and then I turn around and I hear this guy, and they turn around and said, are you Al? And he says, yeah. I says, I'm Gene. He says, you're the son of a bitch causing me these headaches. He says, well, you're in. And I got in there. I got a good job. Eventually, I wound up behind in my rent, and they were about to put me out, but I got wound up with a beautiful job. I mean, I was making $1,000 a week without batting an eyelash. Had a driver's license, you know, pocket full of money. Well, I decided I got everything I need. I got the job. I got money. Now, let me go out to the bar and look for a woman. You know, and I got drunk again. And I called him up and I said, hey, I got drunk. I can't come back. And that's what I did. And it happened 3 or 4 times. And the last time was about 9, 10 years ago. And I told myself, I'm not going back to AA. I'm not going back until I know I'm done or I'm dead. And on June 4th of 2009, I walked into Central Orlando Group, and that's my sobriety date. God willing, in 30 days, I'll have 3 years sober through the grace of God and the fellowship of AA and the 12 steps. And that's where my life took off. Oh my God, did it take off. You talk about dreams beyond your imagination, things that could happen that you would never think that would happen. That's when it took off. Now, I had a hard time coming back here because there's a guy sitting in this room tonight. I couldn't stand that son of a bitch 10 years ago, and I couldn't stand him when I came back in. Okay? Oh, Angel, I'm sorry. Okay. But it's the truth. I had a major resentment against him, and I don't even know why, because I didn't even know him. Okay? But, you know, when I came in, I sat back there, and I sat in that chair, and I sat here for about 3 hours, 2 or 3 hours, and nobody said anything to me. And I thought, shit, I need a drink. And I'm getting ready to get up, and a gentleman walked up to me, and he says, "You okay?" And I said, "No." He says, "What do you need?" I said, "I don't know." I don't know what happened after that. All I know is he told me to call him that night. And I got a list of phone numbers. I wish I knew where that list of phone numbers was today. But I do know that that guy told me to call him that night. And I'm thinking, that son of a bitch doesn't think I'm going to call him. I'm going to show his ass. And pardon my language, but that's pretty much what I my thought pattern. And I called a friend of mine up because I had no place to stay. So what I do is I call the last buddy I know that I run with, and we're drinking and partying and everything else. And I said, "Hey, I'm down in Central at the AA place. Can you come and get me? I need a place to crash." He says, "Yeah." He picks me up. He's got a 12-pack in the car. He's got booze at home. He's got dope at home. And he's got women at home. And he says, "Yeah, man, we got a big party." And I'm like, "All right, cool." And I got in that car and I drove to his house. I don't know what happened. God intervened. It truly was a miracle, because I said to that man, "Can I use your cell phone and can I sleep in your car tonight?" I says, "I'm not coming in, I'm done." And I picked up the phone and I called that guy, and he was blown away. And I don't know what was said or what wasn't said. And I showed up here the next day and the next day and the next day. And after about the third day, Jim, I have to tell this story. I'm sitting in the coffee bar, and I had met Jim, and Jim, you know, trying to work with me, get me to go to a hospital, you know, because I was detoxing. And I'm like, no, I'm going to beat this shit, and you know, I'm doing it my way, you know. And this is before I got a sponsor. And I was sitting in a coffee bar one day. I think it was like my third day, fourth day. And all of a sudden, I get this tap on the shoulder. And I look, and there's this kid, maybe 11, 12 years old. And he looks at me with this smile on his face. And he says, "You know, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. You're going to be all right." And that was Jim Powers' son. And he was right. You know, and I started working the steps as a sponsor. I went into the Salvation ARC program. That was the treatment center I went into. And I made it very clear to people here, too, because I wasn't allowed off the premises for 30 days. The first thing I did is I said, "Okay, I'm leaving for the Salvation Army, so I don't want anybody to think I relapsed." Okay? And because, you know, talk gets around. And that's what I did. And I went in there, and as soon as I got free, the first thing I did is come back here. But during the period that I was in there, that gentleman who was my sponsor, God bless his soul, he relapsed. And I had to find another sponsor. And I got another sponsor. And I called that sponsor, and he never returned my calls. I come up here to talk to him. He was never here. So I came up here to a noon meeting, and I talked to somebody. And somebody introduced me to a gentleman. And a guy named David M. became my sponsor. And David M. took me through the steps. Now, why I was going through the steps and why I was in the Salvation Army ARC, I had graduated that program December of 2009. And on February 9th of 2010, the world-famous Orlando Police Department came to the Salvation Army ARC looking for moi. Said they had a warrant for my arrest. Well, the good guy that I am, you know, I decided I wanted to take a 2-week vacation before I turned myself in. So I called my friends up in Nashville who happened to be in recovery. And I said, I called them up and I says, "Hey, how you doing?" I says, "Hey, possibly I can come out there for a couple of weeks, you know." "Oh, well, what's going on?" "Well, the police are looking for me. There's a warrant for my arrest, and I'm going to take care of a few things before I turn myself in." "Well, have you talked to your sponsor about that?" Shit. So, of course, I called my sponsor, and my sponsor says, "You ain't going to Nashville." My sponsor says, "You're going to turn yourself in. Meet me up at Central." And I came up here, and I talked to y'all, and y'all supported me in it. My sponsor came up here, took me out for a meal, went down to the Salvation Army, talked to the major, told him what I was doing, said goodbye to my friends. half of them didn't believe I was going to turn myself in, and went down to 33rd. And we thought it would be pretty quick, that I'd be going in, be, you know, put back on probation. Well, judge didn't see it that way. Judge says, no freaking way am I putting you back on probation. You're doing time. She says, you can go to prison or you can go to 33rd. You know, and I think she really wanted to put me in prison. But thank God for the attorney that I had. And I wound up doing, I got 51 weeks in 33rd Orange County Correctional Facility. And while I was there, I got into a drug and alcohol program. I was 8 months sober. And it was the easiest 8 months I ever did in my life for all the times that I've done in jail, because I had the support of you. And the last two people in the world that I thought would be even think of coming to visit me were the first two people to come and see me the day after I got sentenced. And that in turn turned into a wonderful friendship. And then when I got out, even before that, I was invited to a Christmas party, which I was never been. I never celebrated Christmas because we didn't have Christmases when we were kids. You know, so to be invited to that house was a very overwhelming experience for me. Went through the steps with my sponsor. Eventually, I had gotten out of jail, and on September 11th, and I was in Osceola County Jail because they had transferred me, because Osceola had a warrant for my arrest as well. So I got in front of the judge there, and this judge wanted to give me 10 more months, and I'm thinking there's no way I could do 10 more months after just doing seven plus months. And I made it clear to make it a point to tell Judge Morgan, hey, wait a minute. Do you remember before you put me on probation and court ordered me to this place, I asked you to do that. You were going to give me time served. So why are you giving me 10 more months? And he says, oh, I remember that case. He says, yeah, okay, you can have a seat. And the last thing I heard him say was 8 months. I didn't hear anything else. And I got in the van and I was pretty angry and I was ready to give up. And I said, I can't do 8 more months. And somebody in that van heard me, and they said, you ain't doing 8 more months. You're getting out today. He said, 8 more months. She said, you didn't hear what he said? I said, no. He said, 8 months with 7 months time served. So with your game time, you're out today. Here's another God story. Where's Jonathan? Oh, yeah, there he is. I got out about 1 a.m. in the morning at Osceola County Jail. And I called my sponsor. He couldn't pick me up because his daughter was there. I called my friend Marty, but he didn't answer his phone. So I called my friend Jonathan, who lives all the way out in Lake Mary. Well, he answered his phone. Now, the story that I got when I called him, and I said, can you come and get me? He said, are you serious? They're letting you out? I said, yeah. He said, I'm on my way. Did not hesitate to come and get me. However, the story goes like this. Jonathan broke his phone that day, and it hasn't worked all day. He didn't get any calls. He couldn't make any calls. His phone worked long enough for me to ask him to come and get me. Because right after I hung up with that, when he was calling me for trying to call me for directions, or I was trying to call him back, his phone did not work again. Oh. It worked long enough for him to, for me to ask him to come and get me. And about an hour and a half later, he found the jail and he picked me up. And the next day, he took me out on the St. John's River, and we went down to the Blue Springs, and we had a little barbecue. And I think Tony was there, and we had it was a wonderful experience. And I got right back into AA. I was doing service work here. I was doing a greeter. I was doing raffle, and I got right back into it. When I came back here, y'all would not slack off of me. Y'all were like, get right back in the midst, you know, and I did. You know, through all this, quickly tell you, I was in Osceola County Jail, and I got a letter from Bucks County, Pennsylvania, Children and Family Services. Now, my brothers and sisters were all raised in foster homes and orphanage homes, and I didn't know what that was regarding. And when I finally got out of jail, I had wrote them several things, you know, to have anything to do with my brothers and sisters in their foster homes, to have anything to do with this affair that I had with this married woman for 5 months when her and I ran away from her husband and what have you. And when I finally got out and I called them, and they said, yes, it has to do with the woman that you ran away with. She had a child. That child is yours. That child was given up for adoption and wants to be reunified with you. I never knew it. This woman never told me she was pregnant. She never said a word to me. Today I'm here to tell you I have a 24-year-old daughter. Her name is Jessica. She is absolutely amazing, and we have a phenomenal relationship that we're building. And she gets to be a child again, and I get to be a father to my daughter. And when we met, she'd asked me, after we talked for a while, she says, "Well, I have a question. Is it okay if I call you Dad?" And I said, "Honey, that's something that's earned, and I didn't earn that right." And she says, "But that's what I want." And I said, "If that's what you want, I'm honored." And that's what she calls me today. And I talked to her pretty much. I got to go up and meet her for the first time back in October. And got to see her in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Got to hear her sing. She's amazing. She's wonderful. And I love her with all my heart. And I do anything I can for her. And she is amazed at me for what I've been through and staying sober, going to jail and everything else. Because when I went to jail, it was devastating to her because I was supposed to go up and meet her in February or September, and I couldn't make it because I had to go to jail and I had no way to call her. So I had my sponsor transfer the message to her. And then my daughter wrote me and says, "I'm very proud of you." Now, through all this, I'm on Facebook. And my daughter tells me to open up Facebook. That's how I can find a little bit out about her and stay in touch with her. I figure, lo and behold, let me look up my sisters. Well, I look up my sisters on Facebook, and lo and behold, they're there with their maiden name and married name. And I send them a message doing the ninth step because it's the only way I can contact them because they want nothing to do with me. And I just plainly said, "I'm sorry for anything or whatever I have done to hurt you or not to speak to me. I don't really know what I've done, but I apologize and I'll never bother you again." I had to accept the fact that I was never going to see my family, and I did that in my fifth step with my sponsor. I said I have to let it go because I carried it. Again, it's me being a victim. You know, that victim thing is a tough friggin' thing. You know, it'll keep me in a closed mind, unwillingness, you know, and it'll keep me far away from a God of my understanding, and that's what it did. So, lo and behold, I got a message back about 2 weeks later from my one sister. She says, "We are not brother and sister. We weren't raised like that. However, I will be your friend, and I don't want to drudge up the past." Perfectly acceptable to me. At least I get to touch bases with my sister. My other sister, I got a phone call shortly after that, and it was my brother. Now, mind you, my brother's sitting here on the phone, and he's my biggest partying partner. He was my younger brother, not my oldest brother. And about 7 years ago, we got into a pretty hard drinking and doing our thing. And he gets on the phone, "Hey, Gene, it's Rich. How you doing?" "Oh, I'm doing great. How are you?" He says, "Well, you know, it's been tough. You know, I'm drinking a bottle of this every day, and I'm talking about how I'm going to kill myself, and I'm thinking, I can't deal with this." But then his next sentence was, "I went into treatment and I'm in recovery. I'm 4 months clean," or something like that. A week later, he calls me up. He says, "Hey, can I come down and visit you?" And he came down, and I got to see my little brother. A week after that, I told my sisters about my daughter. My one sister looked her up, and they became very good friends. My other sister then accepted my friend request, and she apologized to me because she said, "There was really no reason for me not to talk to you." She says, "I'm truly sorry for hurting you." And I said, "Nobody hurt anybody. It's just what it is, what it is." And she says, "We need to stick together." My sister now supports me. She supports my brother in recovery, and I got my baby brother who's in recovery. And my sister is going to meetings now. So there's 5 out of 6 kids that are in recovery or working toward recovery, because that's the life we knew. You know, not that we didn't have opportunities. That's just what it was. So never say never. That's the only thing I can tell you. Never say never. When you don't think something can happen, believe you me, if you put your best foot forward, recovery, I'm not going to sit here and tell you every day is easy, every day is a piece of cake. Recovery can be hard, but it can be as hard as I choose it to be. I could stew in misery for as long as I choose to, or I could choose to get out of myself, as I'm always reminded every time I go through something and I'm poor me, poor me, poor me. Work with another alcoholic. Find somebody to help. Find something to do. Get out of myself. You know, because I've been in myself too long. And when I start getting up in here, I start thinking. That is not to say that in the time that I've been sober that I do not think of drinking. But I don't want to go back to that hell that I came from. And I don't want to go through the shit that I went through to get sober. You know? And I sit here to tell you, man, the streets are tough. The biggest struggle I go through today is work. You know? It's just tough finding a job. The age, my record, okay? I screwed everything up, man, but I keep my head above water. I call my sponsor, I bitch him, well, have you done this? He's like, son of a bitch, I don't want to hear that. You know? Or I'll come up here and talk to some of the guys, well, have you gone through this? You know? I have also gone through something here that is not AA related that I didn't realize how much anger I had in me. That's all I can tell you. I did not know how much anger I had in me, and I went to a self-help thing, and I found out pretty quick. You know, I do. You know, there's a lot of issues that I still have that I have to deal with, and I discovered one of them last night. I was watching the movie Precious, and some of that stuff in there triggered. Really scared the hell out of me because it triggered me. It gave me flashbacks of my childhood, and but it was a beautiful movie. You know, recovery is fun. You know, today I didn't come in here this time for a relationship. I didn't come in here for a job. I came in here because I was too afraid to kill myself and didn't want to die, but I didn't know how to live. And I wanted to learn. I wanted to give it a shot. I had no idea what to expect. If you ask me if I expected to stay sober for 3 years, because when I used to hear people say they have 3 years of sobriety or 5 years or 20 years, you're full of shit. I can't. If you drank like I drank, how the heck can you stay sober that long? I just don't see it. Well, I'm here to tell you. I'm living proof. So they must be living proof. And I didn't do it. And the only thing I do is put one foot in front of my other. God speaks to me through you. And through each and every one of you, I learn to stay sober one day at a time through doing the 12 steps, working the principles, applying them to my everyday life, inside and outside the room. See, the real work isn't in here. The real work is out there. When you're out there and nobody's looking, what are you doing? What are you saying? How are you treating people? That's what I look at. That's where the work is. You know? I want to thank each and every one of you for being here tonight. Thank you.